There is no correlation between accurate mental health diagnosis and favorable treatment outcomes.
When you see the world through that lens, you start to ask questions.
And I think that a lot of people don't even realize how much of psychiatry and mental health is just a guessing game.
Yeah, think about it kind of more like an Enneagram, but with objective data. The ones who were on oral contraception and then also were on antidepressants actually had only a 24% response to the antidepressant treatment versus the group who weren't on oral contraception, who had a 71%.
Welcome back to Healthy as a Mother. I am your podcast co-host, Dr. Morgan McDermott. And this is the show for becoming and being a mother, where Dr. Leah and I share our natural women's health and motherhood guidance that you've been looking for through our fresh, functional, and balanced lens. And today on the show, we have Dr. Steve Rondeau to talk about how he uses EEG brain scans to objectively evaluate mental health concerns, which leads to more successful treatment and understanding of the brain patterns that we all have. So we talk about how this can help in marriages, how it can help between parent and child, or about women recovering from postpartum, and even things down to how does a brain respond differently when it's on hormonal birth control or not to things like antidepressive medications. I believe that one day this technology will be a routine offering in clinics, just in the same way that it is to do genetic testing to understand our predispositions for methylation factors and whatnot. There is a lot of information here. I think you're going to love it. So let's go ahead and dive in. Okay, welcome back, everybody. And today we have a very special guest, Dr. Steve Rondeau, who I don't know if you actually even know this, but you were the reason why I became a naturopathic doctor. No pressure.
Oh, that's fantastic. No, I did not know that.
Yeah, you and Mary. So Dr. Steve and Dr. Mary are husband and wife, and they work in this clinic in Fort Collins, which when I was in college and I was sort of having a quarter-life crisis, freaking out, realizing I don't want to be a veterinarian and I don't want to work with animals now. And my entire life I wanted to. What am I going to do? I precepted you, and I actually saw Dr. Mary as a patient. And I was just blown away by the conversations that I witnessed, by how quickly my own health things that I was working with Dr. Mary resolved with like very little, just a few lifestyle changes, you know, which I know is the whole point of naturopathic medicine. But up at that point of my life, I had been raised very conventionally. And so anyway, I just wanted to tell you that. But you are here today because, and I'm so thankful for you because of your position and influence on my life and why I'm here. And I'm super excited to talk to you today because I think everybody will find this interesting. In the world of like naturopathic psychiatry, functional mental health world, you have written an amazing new book that is called Think Like a Brain, A New Map for Treating Minds That Don't Fit the Manual, specifically using tools that can objectively look at with brain scans, figure out what's actually going on in the brain so that we're not doing this guessing game thing. And I think that a lot of people don't even realize, and we're going to get into that more, how much of psychiatry and mental health is just a guessing game without any actual data to back up that that's what's happening for this particular patient. But let me introduce you really quickly and read your bio because I think it's really impressive. So Dr. Steve Rondeau is the founder of Axon EEG Solutions. So like when we say EEG, we're thinking like, yes, the brain scan, EEG. Helping patients and providers escape psychiatry's guessing game. An award-winning doctor who has analyzed over 50,000 brain scans. That's a lot. He uses objective biological data to stop the dangerous cycle of medication at trial and error, which I think our audience will be very appreciative of because using medication for psychiatry or mental health things, I think is something that the crunchy moms really resist, you know? And so I know we'll talk more about that. Dr. Rondeau's journey began in developmental pediatrics, searching for objective markers in autism. That's the time that I was shadowing you, was with the autistic patients. The turning point came inside a rehab center where he scanned a patient labeled treatment resistant for anxiety. The brain data revealed that she did not have anxiety at all. She had ADHD. Once treated correctly, her incurable panic attacks disappeared. After seeing this pattern repeated, Dr. Rondeau concluded modern psychiatry practices with an outdated map. Without objective data, care relies on guesswork, often pathologizing context-dependent strengths. Using brain-based data, he reframes symptoms as signals, matching individuals to environments where their brains can thrive. I think it's brilliant and beautiful, and it makes so much sense. And one thing that you said in one of our prior conversations was the idea that so many providers, and of course then also moms and patients, don't even realize that there is no correlation between accurate mental health diagnosis and favorable treatment outcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that is crazy to me. So how have we possibly gone on this long with the model that we do?
Yeah, it's wild. It's wild. I mean, we covered so much. I mean, in some ways, it's we could sort of stop there because it covered kind of everything, you know, in the beginning of the intro. But there's so many little nuances of things that we've learned doing mental health for this long and seeing this many people. And I think what's kind of interesting is probably like your practice, you don't see people who have garden variety issues. You see people who have tried everything else, and then they come in with 10% of energy left, no money, and they're like, what do we do to help this, you know, this issue? And so when you see the world through that lens, you start to ask questions. And so my brain works in the context of patterns, and naturally I gravitated towards this, and I think this is what's, you know, ultimately manifested into what we have now, which is this enormous data set to be able to predict and understand how and if people are going to respond to any treatment. It doesn't have to be medications. In fact, I really don't, it doesn't matter to me what people decide to do. It's just, we can't be going on using treatments for mental health, especially in kids, that is used indiscriminately. It's just based on a label. So it's definitely been a journey. And I think even having kids of my own has really opened my eyes to that too, you know, because it becomes a whole different ball game, you know. I remember in residency doing blood draws and screaming kids without flinching, but then when you have some of your own, it's kind of like, maybe we don't need to do a blood draw on this kid, you know.
Yeah, you have that compassion layer now.
Yeah, and so many interesting things. And I think what would be neat to get into too, maybe if we have time, is I didn't realize your early work was around animals. And so we've found a fingerprint that tends to show a connection between people's affinity towards animals and not. Okay, so like people who have this particular pattern or phenotype, we call it, actually have a stronger connection to animals that goes beyond what we just kind of talk about in our general conversation. So it could be...
You mean like on brain scan that you can see that?
Yeah, we published a paper about this in maybe 5 years ago or so, about this particular pattern. So I know this isn't a podcast about your brain and animals, but if we get into
that. No, but I think that's really interesting because, so I'm imagining, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm imagining a picture of like, you know, it's the two hemispheres of the brain and like certain areas are lit up with like rainbow colors, right? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah, so basically how EEG works is that traditionally it's been around for about 100 years and we've measured electrical activity in the brain for a long time. And it used to show up on these long sort of scrolls, and you'd have to look through and analyze these long scrolls for, you know, a long time for recording. And then over time, it's become digitized, you know, of course, put into a computer. And so now we can see the squiggly lines much quicker on a computer. And so that's what a neurologist would do if you had concussion, seizures, maybe some neurological condition, they would do that. And we have neurologists on our team that perform that task. But where it's taken a step further was mostly sort of gotten a surge in the 90s where they take that actual data, all the squiggly lines, and they turn it into numbers. Okay, and so you can actually quantify how much is there and where is it located. Okay, and by doing that, we can create a map. And so the map is like what you're describing, which is an image of the brain with the brainwaves overlaid on top in a way that shows distribution and amplitude. So where is it located and how much is there? It's kind of like looking at a 3D map of, like, you know, the Rocky Mountains. You can see where the mountains are and then how much, how big they are and where they're distributed. So that's what we're trying to do.
And then you can see based on, this is like so mind-blowing to me because you want to think All right, this is a little morbid, but you want to think your personality or the things that you like and don't like and stuff is sort of just like you, or it's based on your soul, but we can see some of this stuff in a brain scan that tells you, like, you could take a brain scan of a person and then probably spit out like an astrologer. Yeah. Like, you like this, you don't like this, blah, blah, blah. Is that true?
I think, you know, astrology is a funny one. I would probably equate it more to kind of closely.
Well, no, I'm not saying it's like astrology, but you know what I'm saying? They'll be like, oh, well, you're a Libra, so then blah, blah, blah. But you could look at my brain scan and pick things out about me.
Yeah, think about it kind of more like an Enneagram, but with objective data, you know?
And okay, it's not Enneagram. So
much, yeah, it's not so much See, the way we think this works, and this is a new theory that we're sort of evolving, it's what I refer to as the input filter of the mind. And so this is a new paper that, now that the book is about to be released, I have some time to put into it. But what we think is actually happening, and this is kind of high level, but it's definitely applicable to anyone who has a brain, is that we have filters in our brain that we can measure, okay? And these are the patterns that we've been measuring for a long time, like, you know, probably the last 30 years or something that have been published, okay? And those filters become a sort of a bias that we create for the interpretation of what happens in our environment. So, for example, this happens a lot with my kids. I always use this example. There's a store here in our community. It's called Shields. I don't think they have them out by you guys, but it's this huge...
We actually do. We have one, and it's gigantic.
It is awesome. Okay, so you go inside, and there's this giant Ferris wheel there, okay? And so the kids are so excited. They want to go on the Ferris wheel. This is going to be awesome. And I'm looking at this thinking, like, I could die like 12 different ways on this thing. Like, there's no way. There's no way, okay? Now, same, you know, genetics, same environment, you know, they're half my genetics. And we're walking into shows and we're looking at this and seeing this filter through two totally different experiences. And so, you know, a lot of that we like to think, okay, this is our history. Maybe this is, did you fall off a Ferris wheel once? Did you watch some videos on YouTube? Like, what happened, you know? But through the lens of the brain filters, we can actually look at that and predict, like, who would something like that be attractive for, and who else would not like that. And so we can look at these what we call brain-based filters and understand how people might respond to environmental cues. And for me, that's fascinating. I think it's fascinating for relationships. It's fascinating for parenting. It's fascinating for, the race car driver that we're shooting the Netflix special on right now. It's the same thing. You can see these patterns and you can understand who will excel in these certain areas and who won't. And now just extrapolate that to something more concrete, like everyday applications, such as, you know, medication response or failure, and all the other treatments and things that we're doing. So it just gives us a lens where we stop talking about these things as this sort of mystical thing that we caught out in space, and it's more concrete, and we could say, like, look at, you know, what's there. And in fact, even the absence of data becomes a data point as well. And so that could be something we talk about, you know, a little bit too. But the presence or absence of data is very helpful.
Yeah, because then you can... So if you have a child that comes in, or a mom, so yeah. We're going to talk in this podcast about both moms through the lens of moms and kids, because I think it's most applicable to our audience. And so, and then one other thing that you said before we started recording was about a brand new study that came out showing the differences between how women respond to antidepressants based on if they're on hormonal birth control or not, which I think our audience, you know, we talk a lot about birth control on this podcast as something that has a time and place, but also has unfortunately been positioned as something like totally benign and it has no difference on anything. And if especially isn't going to affect your long-term period or your fertility, which is just not true. That's more of Dr. Leah's wheelhouse. But can you tell me about that study and what the findings were?
Yeah, so this is an interesting paper. It just came out over the weekend in Nature. And I've been talking to the researchers since because it was fascinating. I tend to follow a lot of research, especially as it comes out, so that we can apply new knowledge to what we deliver for patients, you know, new biomarkers. But one of the things they found that was really interesting, they were looking at how oral contraception affects the EEG, which has been done before, I think, at different levels, but looking at differences between women's brains, men's brains, which there's a lot more interest now in the unique biology of women's brains versus males, which is largely what has been studied. And so they looked at this and they said, okay, like the difference between women who had been on oral birth control and ones who hadn't, there was largely no difference in their brain patterns, okay? And so, yeah, I was like, okay, that's not like super interesting. But what was really fascinating was that the ones who were on oral contraception and then also were on antidepressants actually had only a 24% response to the antidepressant treatment versus the group who weren't on the oral contraception who had a 71% response to the antidepressant treatment. So basically saying that, again, the biology is so important when it comes to understanding and how we treat the brain. And this is largely the way the field is now going, is to say, hey, this isn't just like a brain, you know, in this like skull, you know, functioning in isolation. There's other factors that we have to account for when we're treating people. And, you know, the DSM has given us a shared language to talk about these things. Like when you say ADD or you say depression, like I know what you mean generally, but it doesn't tell us anything about what's going on underneath. All it is a check engine light. It's all it is, you know? And so if we understand that about the unique physiology of women, we can understand that, like, hey, this is important in the way we treat. Like, a 30-year-old woman who's never had a baby, who's not on hormones, their depression is different than someone who may have just had a baby and, you know, is on birth control now, but we give them the same treatment. It's like maddening. It's so maddening that we still practice this way, you know? I joke, I did this presentation in Phoenix last summer, but, you know, if Abraham Lincoln came here and did an evaluation now, 200 years later, for his depression, it would largely look the way that it does right now. It's just, hey, President Lincoln, like, how are you feeling? Tell me, you know, about your depression. And, oh, yeah, this is bad. Like, here's your treatment. The treatment would be a little different, but the evaluation is exactly the same. It's crazy. It's crazy. Tell me any other area in medicine that is the same, like your cardiac workup, like cancer is like super advanced, like no way. But in mental health, it's still the same.
Yeah, that's bananas.
Yeah.
Thinking about, you know, postpartum mental health stuff.
Yeah.
And why some people, like for instance me, I have had 4 postpartums and one of them was terrible. Because of a lot of, you know, lack of support type features. Mm-hmm. One of them was amazing. One of them should have been amazing and wasn't. I don't really know why. And then one of them was fine again. You know, and it's like, this is something that a lot of people struggle with in the shame of like, oh my gosh, I'm not meant to be a mom or whatever. And I think that sometimes when we can have some objective data, this conversation actually came up the other day with a friend about fibroids, and she found out she'd had these big fibroids and they cause a lot of problems in her pregnancy, like preterm labor and things. She wants to have more kids, but she's terribly, you know, fearful of what is going to happen. And she's been on this journey of like removing all sources of external estrogens and detoxification and doing all these things. It's not changing the size of the fibroids. And she's feeling a lot of shame on herself. Like, what did I do to cause this? And we were able to highlight for her, it may just be part of your genetics. It may just be the way they may not be modifiable. You know, growth can be hard in this way. And it's not something you did or didn't do. You know, sometimes there are factors like that, but we don't need to have the shame on ourselves that you just can't, like, so then back to the postpartum, you just can't handle it. You're just not cut out to be a mom. You must not love your kids. Like, whatever the things are that we as women say, which trust me, I've said all of them to myself as well. I think something like this could be so helpful to just go, whoa, no, this is actually like beyond my.
Yeah, absolutely. The shame and the self-deprecation is definitely a very predictable and stable marker we identified about, I don't know, maybe 6 years ago or so. It's one of the newer markers that we measure, and it's very predictable. And just like all of these markers, I really want people to understand, because it took me a long time to get to this place professionally. I mean, lots and lots of brain scans, lots of talking to people. And, you know, we don't do these with just the clinic here in town. We do them with clinics across the country. And so we take in data from all sorts of demographics, from memory centers to Hollywood celebrity clinics to, you know, women's clinics. I mean, all kinds of different settings, personal injury, lots of different types. Okay. And so we get to see these through these different lenses. And I think that guilt shame cycle is an interesting one to talk about, because just like all the patterns, they have strengths and challenges. And when I first started doing this stuff, it was all about find what's wrong. Does my kid have ADD? Show me. And do I have depression? Show me. You know, that was kind of how we thought about it. But the more and more we started to do this, particularly working with high performance groups, like some of the people we saw either through like our elite athlete programs or even in rehabilitation centers for drug and alcohol use, you start to realize that these patterns serve people in the right environment. So I think the mothering is such a fantastic conversation to a starter. It's such a good conversation starter because these big transitions for people are, they're huge, what I call pattern disruptors. You know, they disrupt our ecosystem the way we knew it. And so what happens with a lot of people is that we have these underlying patterns and we'll say this is the recipe that makes us up, okay? And if we're functioning pretty well, meaning like, you know, we're happy, we have a job, maybe we're in a relationship, things are going well, okay? Subjectively, they're going well. And we have a big disruption, what often that tells us is that our needs were being met in that environment. Again, we can measure what these needs likely would be, okay? Creativity, you know, purpose, these things that we can start to measure through the brain patterns in the EEG, okay? Safety, lack of overwhelm, predictability, you know, cognitive challenges, all of those sorts of things, okay? So we can measure those and we look for those, okay? But then when we have a pattern disruptor like an engagement, like graduating school, like a kid who leaves the house when they're, you know, after their college or whatever, all of these things are big transitions in people's lives, particularly in women. And those patterns served us at a time. They served us, okay? So like the negative self-referencing patterns that we refer to as the kind of the self-deprecating and perfectionistic sort of cluster that they tend to manifest as can serve us well when we're in school, let's say, and you get a B on your test and you're like, oh, I know I can do better. I'm going to get an A next time. B is not good enough. I can do good, okay? Or I can do, you know, I can do even better. And so that can serve us in that environment. It can serve us as a, you know, as an athlete, right? It's like, okay, I got this award. I'm going to go get another one. I wrote this book. I'm going to write a bestseller. You know, and that cascade can drive us. But what happens is when those things are removed from our ecosystem, like a woman who takes time off from work, but work was her main sort of approval source, we'll say. Okay, she, you know, she had good people at work that recognized her work and she, you know, had accomplishments and these sorts of things. And it isn't just women, it's men too, but then that goes away because now they're at home. Now they need a new validation source, okay? And again, I'm not picking on moms, this is everybody. This happens to professional athletes too, just like the one I was talking about. And now you take that away, and then it shows up as symptoms, and we say, oh, you're depressed. Oh, you're, you know, whatever, fill in the blank. And then we start looking, we're like, oh, geez, is it sleep? Is it my hormones? Like, you know, what is going on? But what we don't realize is that, you know, when you take someone out of their environment that was serving them, even with what we would, you know, research would deem as dysfunctional brain patterns, they can work really, really well when the environment suits them. And so I think that's what's so fascinating about this work is the more I do this, the more I realize there's no bad brains. It's just, does the brain work in the environment that you've created? And if it doesn't, let's start to think about what those things are that has changed, you know? And what do we wanna do? Do we wanna treat it with meds, herbs, supplements, lifestyle? What do we wanna do?
Yeah. As we're talking about birth and postpartum support, I wanna share an underrated tip with you. That tip is to continue taking your prenatal. Pregnancy and postpartum are the most nutritionally demanding phases of a woman's life. Many women stop taking their prenatal after birth, but we recommend taking it for at least the first 9 months postpartum or the entirety of the time that you're breastfeeding. My favorite prenatal is Needed's Prenatal Multi, and it's the most robust formula that I've seen in the market. It contains bioavailable nutrients in their evidence-based dosages, well above the bare minimum that a lot of prenatals settle for. Their quality standards are top tier with transparent third-party testing and over 10,000 practitioners now recommending the brand. And now we have the results from their IRB-approved clinical study that confirm the results of what we've been seeing clinically. Women who take the prenatal multi have significantly higher blood levels of critical nutrients for pregnancy and postpartum. This includes vitamin D, B6, B12, riboflavin, vitamin K2. Only women in the Needed group reach the adequate, sufficient levels of vitamin D. Vitamin D plays a big role in your immune health, your mood, and your energy production.
all things that are really important during your postpartum season. And while there's many different ways that you can support yourself postpartum, continuing to take your prenatal is a really simple, easy way to cover all your bases. It's one of the most impactful habits that we can have, and Needed makes it easy. Learn more about the study at thisisneeded.com/thrive and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% off your first order. Yes, healthy mother, like a little affirmation for yourself.
Do you think that it ever helps, like, for that particular situation, which is so common, I'm glad that you brought that up, women who take time off work to have a baby and then they feel like big identity loss and shift, or the perfectionist type of person who in school really thrived from pushing themselves, and then maybe they get into career or maybe they don't, and that's still kind of like intense mental energy of doing everything just so and just right. It's not applicable to their current environment. And so then it's causing mental distress. It's just like with any mental health thing, you know, like our adaptive patterns, like if we had to adapt to a very high stress childhood, and now we have these like hypervigilance things and whatever it was that helped keep us, you know, in survival for those years. Once that has all gone away and now you're living in a different scenario, but you're still behaving in those patterns, that is the dysfunction. And that is the thing we have to let go. And, you know, this is the whole point of like doing mental, you know, therapy and whatever, blah, 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 is understanding that. That's so interesting though, to think, because these are much more subtle. You wouldn't really even, sometimes people wouldn't be able to call upon these. So, but do you think that like in the case of a woman who's got a 3-month-old and she hasn't gone back to work yet and she's having a really big struggle, it, you do a brain scan on her, you see that she's got this pattern that was serving her well in her like higher up, maybe, you know, CEO or some leadership position of work. And now can you, in just even explaining that to her, I feel like to me, just even explaining it and understanding on a cognitive level, oh my gosh, like that would be extremely healing for me. Do you find that to be true?
Where people 100%. And I tell you where it really was the most validating was when we were working in substance use centers with kids, 17 to 25, okay? And these kids were coming in, and by all external filters, most people would think these are just entitled kids. A lot of them were well-to-do kids, well-to-do families. These are very expensive centers. I mean, these are probably, you know, $10,000, $20,000 a month. So these are, you know, people aren't there just hanging out, okay? And so they're there from these families, and it looks like just a privileged kid with too much time on their hands. But when you actually look at their brain scans, it was like, hold on a second, this kid is just trying to meet their needs with a substance that does what their needs say on the brain scan. Like, no one would come in, be using a substance that didn't match the brain patterns, okay? It just, it doesn't happen. So you have a fingerprint in your brain scan, okay? And it shows that, we'll say, for example, you have what's called a low alpha to beta ratio in the back part of your brain, a very common pattern in the substance use center, particularly with opiates, alcohol, and THC, okay? And so now they're coming with low alpha beta ratios and they're using things like opiates, THC, and alcohol. And it's like, well, yeah, of course you are. Like, that scratches that itch for you. And the medications you're on haven't done that. So yeah, logically you would do that because you probably saw that somewhere growing up in your, you know, rock star dad's environment. And that's what you saw people do. And so you model that behavior and you, you know, continue to do that. And then it looks like an addiction. And so it's very, very, very validating. And I think it can be validating in a lot of ways, from spousal type stuff to parenting strategies. Like, I have two boys and they have different brain scans, and what works for one doesn't work for the other. And so you could sit here and be like, oh man, like, what am I doing wrong as a parent? How come I'm failing this kid? Like, maybe I just need to spend more time, or maybe it's something I said. But if you look at the brain scans, you understand that they have different needs, okay? And so this came out actually as we were writing the book. It was really sort of a beautiful moment because we had just gotten a new puppy. And the puppy was a husky, okay? And we took him down to Arizona, and Arizona was very hot. And the husky was not happy in Arizona. And so we bring him back, you know, we take him to the mountains, he's playing in the snow, and the dog's happy as can be. And it was this idea of like, oh, hold on a second, it's the same dog, it's a different environment, and one environment is thriving and the other, it's struggling. Like, what's different? It's not the dog, it's the environment. And that's when we came up with the husky phenomenon that we ended up putting into the book, and now into several other papers that we've written. But it's really that same idea with moms. It's like we were in this environment, and then everything shifted, and now we have these issues. It doesn't negate the fact that hormones play a role, and thyroid issues and, you know, sleep and all these other things play a role. But again, we can't go and treat mental health conditions until we know what's going on, you know? And there's so many people that have come into the clinic, particularly women. We see this a lot in women in their like 20s, where they come in diagnosed with depression for years, treated for depression for years. And in reality, what we see in the scans is that they have untreated ADHD. And so this isn't even just us. This is, we've seen this in a number of other people's publications too. And when you understand that's the pattern, then the conversation begins, what do you want to do? Do you want to go on meds? Do you want to go on herbs? Do you want to change your environment? Like, what do you want to do? Or you just want to understand that this is your brain pattern and you're trying to get a husky to live in the desert, you know?
Okay, and with ADHD, because there's different types, are you able to see that on the brain scan?
Yeah, and it's well beyond what the DSM, you know, our diagnostic manual suggests. I mean, they suggest that we have, you know, a hyperactive kind and a type without hyperactivity, but in the scans we actually probably have, I mean, no less than 12 different ways ADHD could show up. And if you, I've never done the math on this, I probably will soon, but if you take the possible amount of treatments, including stimulants and non-stimulants, okay, and then take the known phenotypes of, or the known subtypes of ADHD that we see in the brain scan, and do the math on that, I mean, the possibility of ever getting that right is like, it's infinitesimally small. I mean, generally speaking, stimulants are going to make anyone focus better, okay? Someone responding to a stimulant doesn't confirm they have ADHD. It just tells you the medicine worked. That's it. If I drink coffee, I am more focused. It doesn't mean I have ADHD. And so if we can look at the scan and start to understand what is going on in that person's brain combined with their environment, then you can start to have a conversation about, is this really ADHD or not?
Okay, and so then how do you get to the root cause of what it is that's causing their ADHD? Or like depression, like a postpartum depressive woman, is it because she has something going on, you know, with hormones or a nutrient deficiency or lack of support, or, you know, the brain scan will tell you, okay, she's got depression. And then how do you take that information to figure out the proper treatment based on root cause?
Yeah, I think a lot of the clinics that do the best with our data are the ones that do what I refer to as sort of neck down and neck up assessments. So we look at the neck up first and we see what is going on that they're talking about subjectively. What's going on in their brain scan? Okay. And then the neck down assessment is with all the other questions you ask that clue you into the physiological possible contributions, like, you know, my hair's falling out, or I'm, you know, not sleeping, or I'm having hot flashes. Like, okay, well, maybe we should look at your thyroid, you know? And so you start to look at the test, but every other thing that you test has a test to go along with it to confirm. The brain doesn't do that, you know, in mental health. And that's the direction the field is now starting to go, is to say, hey, you know, all these other specialties, pulmonology, cardiology, you know, gastroenterology, they all have a test to help confirm your suspicion and then validate it after you do treatment. But mental health doesn't have that. They just say, tell me how you're feeling. Okay, I think this treatment might work. And there's a whole smorgasbord of them. And then you go and give that to them, and then they come back and say, how do you feel? It's all subjective. It's all subjective. And you want to hear the crazy part about it is that I spend a fair amount of time on the message boards of people struggling with mental health concerns. It helps us to understand the language. It helps us to understand like what people are kind of going through, and to speak to them, you know, through our different channels and so forth. But, I mean, you wouldn't believe how many people go on to these groups and say, I was suggested this, you know, what do you guys think? And it's like, are you like, this is how we're picking our psych meds these days? Like, this is bananas. This is absolutely bananas. So yeah, to your point, when we get to the root cause, I think the other thing to really think about, and this is a really interesting story, and I think we'll hit home with you and the listeners, because I can tell you're tracking very well with what we're talking about here, is that the absence of information is just as helpful as the presence. So for example, probably was around the time that we met, this was years ago, and we had a woman who came into the clinic. I'd done a brain scan, and I didn't really know anything about her other than she had come from out of state and she was here for a comprehensive evaluation. I looked at it and I said, this is pretty unremarkable. Like, what's going on? Why would this person come from, you know, 10 states away to come out to Colorado to do a scan and treatment? They said, well, she's schizophrenic. She's been hospitalized. She's, you know, really bad place. Like, she was struggling. And I said, well, her brain scan looks pretty normal here. It's unremarkable. We really don't see a lot that's going on. I said, why don't we look at, you know, X, Y, Z? And so at that time, I had suspicions that there was an immune issue going on. So we had checked a particular test that has to look at the way folate's processed in the brain and a couple other things. And sure enough, that's what was going on. This is actually a more fascinating story than I thought. Let me tell you where it lands. What happened was she had folate receptor antibodies in her brain that were blocking the ability of folate to get to where it needs to go to help make neurotransmitters and basically help us feel good. Okay, and this person was manifesting symptoms as schizophrenia. Okay, and actually we've gone on to publish this case study, and but what was so remarkable about this situation was the absence of information prevented us from doing what psychiatrists would do all the time, which is give antipsychotics. You know, hospitalize, you know, give a safety plan, blah, blah, blah. Well, in treating her, she completely transformed her life. She went back on to be, you know, sort of, you know, kind of normal functioning person and ended up having children, which she didn't even think she could have because of this physiological problem. So when I say that, like how much of an impact objective data can have when you're treating mental health conditions, I mean, this is like generational. This is generational for that family, you know?
No one would think to test that in that setting when the symptoms are so intense, they follow along with the DSM definitions of what schizophrenia would be. You would fully expect on the brain scan for there to be. But it is interesting to me that on the brain scan, there wasn't anything that indicated there was like a folate receptor reaction.
Yeah, I think that the part that I sort of left out is that the absence of information can tell us that perhaps, or clue us in that there might be a physiological, you know, underpinning that's going on. But the other thing that tends to happen, and again, this is a little nuanced, and this is after doing this 50,000 times, but what ends up happening
is people who have... 50,000 is such a crazy number.
We've done a lot. We do them for a lot of clinics, and we've done... we can talk about that later, these different groups and so forth. It's really interesting, but the when the severity of symptoms doesn't match the scan, it gets you to start to think about, you know, what might be missing. But what also tends to happen is that we have these underlying fingerprints. Okay, it's like our brain's fingerprint. And when you get sick, okay, and sick I use sort of broadly. Okay, that could be the flu or it could be, you know, gastroenteritis, like some whatever it is. Okay. When you get sick, it tends to aggravate that underlying predisposition, okay? So you're more grumpy, more depressed, more unmotivated or whatever. So fill in the blank of what that sickness is. Like, is it, you know, some shift in your hormones? Is it some other, you know, sleep deprivation? But it tends to just kind of aggravate those underlying patterns. So again, by looking at those patterns, it can help us today with, like, how do we help this person right now? So if you have someone who's, you know, amotivated, can't get off the couch, but they really just like need to exercise and like go socialize. Like, I mean, we can tell them idealistically all the things they need to do in their environment. But if a nudge, 15%, 20% nudge would just help them get off the couch, then maybe that's what we need to do. Or maybe we see brain patterns that are incompatible with alcohol and THC. And we say, hey, I think we should consider based on your data to, you know, let's be sober for a while and see how that does, you know? And I think that, again, can be so validating for people to say, like, hey, it's not just something that the government suggested. It's actually my brain says it's probably not going to do good with pot and booze, you know? And maybe I should stop doing that, you know?
Yeah, I think that especially people who have a personality type of, like, defiance, sort of, don't tell me what to do. And then they feel like, no, I can be, I'm fine. This doesn't have anything to do with that. Mm-hmm. And it can be really, as you said, validating. There's so many angles of validation, honestly. Like,
yeah.
I would love to see what my brain says.
Yeah, we gotta do that.
Let's do it.
Next time we'll come back and do it. We'll do the review for everybody.
Okay, I have so many questions. So back to when you said the alcohol and THC example, it made me think, I wanted to follow up and ask, in the people, as the example of the substance abuse users, the children, the like kind of older children group that you were talking about, and they had like low beta alpha or something, or low alpha something. Mm-hmm. So that finding on brain scan, Is that like a genetic predisposition? Is it a learned behavior through our life? Do we know what percentage of what we find on the scans is just like you're born with this brain, or is this something that happens to your brain from living life?
Yeah, each one of them is different. And I think what's really fascinating about this too is that a lot of science happens in silos, okay? And what we tried to do was take what we were learning and apply it today. I remember vividly as a student, and I'll keep it short, but sitting in lectures and just being floored, like, this is remarkable, this is so exciting. And then you find out at the end, it's just researchers talking about their research. Like, this stuff won't be applicable for 10 years clinically. It's so frustrating. It's so frustrating. So what I did is I took all my frustrations in the field and I brought it to what we're delivering in our brain scans to clinics today. So a lot of this stuff happens in silos, what I was talking about. And so certain markers people have researched, and they do have genetic inheritance through, you know, that we can see through families. Some of them don't. Some of them tend to be what we think related to maybe trauma and even trauma responses. Some of them yeah, they just have different underpinnings. In fact, some of them are starting to change. Oh, here's a doozy. As we are responding to screen use. And so there's some people who study particular markers that have to do with attention. And not surprisingly, we're actually changing the way our brain's wiring in our ability to sustain attention. And so people have measured that, right? You could sit a group of people down and say, how long can they sustain attention versus 10 years ago? That's measurable, but it actually having a shift on our brain. So yeah, some of them tend to have that inheritance type of tendency, and some of them are probably, you know, environmental or a mixture of both. But at the end of the day, if you want your symptoms to get better, the patterns have to change, or the environment has to change to match the patterns, or both, okay? And so as we start to uncover what those patterns are in you, then you can start to think about, okay, what are the needs that go along with that? And I think those needs largely come from three areas. They come from our work, our relationships, and our hobbies. And so those are always the three questions I ask people, not directly, but indirectly. What do you do for fun? What do you like to do when you're not working, when you're feeling well, you know? What are your relationships like? And what do you, you know, and what does work look like? Because I can largely tell how, and not just me, but people, you know, going over the scan, can tell if their needs are being met through those channels, and then start to, you know, focus on like what area isn't being supported. And again, if you have a husky, you know what that looks like. If you come home and you didn't walk your dog, doesn't have a big backyard to run around, and you've been gone all day and you're in an apartment and it chews up all of your shoes and your furniture, you're not surprised. You know, it's like, oh, that stinks, but you're not surprised. But yet we are when it's to do with our brains. And we, you know, we were working in a career, we had a good supportive spouse, we had a, you know, all the stuff was happening. And then, you know, COVID comes, maybe you lose your job, you know, you have a baby, and now you're not working. It's like, okay, now we're surprised why, you know, people are depressed. It's like, no, your needs were met before and they're not now. So what do we want to do? Does that need to be medicated? Maybe. I'm not to judge, but if you're going to do it, pick something that treats the patterns, not just the symptoms that we're having the discussion about, you know.
Electrolytes are trending, yes, but they have been in need of our human bodies for all of time. And if you're drinking another popular and delicious salty electrolyte, here's why you should be drinking Relight instead. First of all, have you ever considered the salt source of these other brands? Because most of them just use table salt. Yeah, table salt. You don't want that. Redmond's Relight Powders uses their unrefined ancient sea salt that they mine in Utah. This salt source contains 60 plus trace minerals along with calcium, chloride, potassium, and magnesium in two different forms, glycinate and malate. The minerals that they use in the Relight Powders are all in the appropriate proportions and forms too. The metabolic needs of pregnancy, healing postpartum, and milk making require more minerals than in other times of your life. Pregnancy itself demands huge increases in your blood volume, which takes, you know, more minerals. Relight is the perfect blend to be sipping during your pregnancy or during your labor even, and especially while you're breastfeeding. It tastes amazing, and my favorite flavors oscillate between mixed berry, lemon lime, and the strawberry lemonade. But you can try a sample pack and try all the flavors for yourself and see what you think. Use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15% on your entire Redmond order. That includes their OG sea salt, other seasonings, bentonite clays, toothpaste, and more.
Well, and I think that comes from like an archaic cultural just misunderstanding. I mean, this is something we talk about on the podcast all the time as it relates to motherhood or women or birth or whatever it is, that there are these ideas that we were sort of all raised and socialized with that are just not true. Maybe we've found out through the last couple of decades that they're not true, or it's been a very long time, but it's still a really hard cultural shift to make. Like the one that I'm always up against is that home birth is inherently safe. And the studies show that if you are a low risk person having a home birth, which high risk people are not going to be in that setting, in a legal sense, at least, the data is very clear that it's an entirely reasonable reasonable option. And the women who are choosing home birth are not negligent. They're not careless, they're, you know, whatever it is. But in this instance, it's like, I at least have thought for a very long time, I still struggle with this, that because it's happening in my brain, I can just change it. I can just think differently. And I can just, or there wouldn't be some sort of actual, I mean, the brain is an organ. Of course, there's going to be differences in organ to organ function. But there's this element of it being in our head and kind of intertwined with our soul and our experience that makes, at least to me, I don't know if you find this in, you know, your experience with patients and clients, but it feels like, I don't know, that I should just be able to like grin and bear it, or like grit through these struggling times. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It's a really good point. And if you could sit here for a couple of days and kind of see how it unfolds, I think it would, you'd start to see, you know, kind of the trends and, you know, pushing through, whether it's as a mother in a relationship or in your environment, unless you're pushing through some discomfort because you're trying to become a better person in some area that you know is, you know, needs work, like we'll just say perfectionism or self-deprecation or whatever. Like, but if you understand that that's a hardwired pattern, we're going to have so much more grace for ourselves. Okay. And so I think, you know, what ends up happening, we talked about this. I talked to a colleague of ours. I did a podcast with her, and we talked about this in the context of perfectionism through the lens of disordered eating in women and in models particularly. And so what was really interesting about this is there's about two or three patterns that show up in the EEG over and over in people who have disordered eating. And when we look at it through that lens, it's very predictable that they will have chosen something like that to begin to take control of. And I think this is really an important point for mothers particularly who have what we call the overwhelmed pattern. Okay, the overwhelmed pattern. So it's an actual pattern where your brain slows down when it's challenged. Okay, and so like a computer, you know, we have our computer here, and we're gonna do our interview. We have the software. It's running a lot of whatever computers run on. I don't know, and it's using that. Okay, but as we demand more of it, you know, we want it to speed up to be able to keep up with what we're doing, but in a brain, some brains can do that, some of them can't. So when we talk about, you know, grit and sort of pushing through, if you have one of those brains that slows down under load, that can look like overwhelmedness. It can look like shutting down. It can look like, I need to come home and have a drink. Kids are too much for me. Maybe I wasn't cut out to be a parent, you know. It can look like, well, how come I can't be a mom and have a job and, you know, be a good wife and, you know, and all of that sort of stuff. And if you couple that with the negative self-referencing patterns and the perfectionism patterns, it creates this endless loop of self-deprecating shame and then being overwhelmed and over. And it's like, where's the buffer on, you know? And so you have to be able to have some sort of outlet. And so oftentimes we'll see that, you know, need for control or that sort of buffer come out in the form of food or in the form of, you know, alcohol or others, some way of checking out. But again, when you have that pattern, or I see that pattern in a brain scan, I'm like, tell me, what do you do to escape? What is your form? And they say, oh, I like to paint. I'm like, great. I say, well, I don't really get any of it because I'm either attending to my kids or I'm cooking or I'm, you know, I'm wearing one of all these mom hats that I have to wear and I don't really get any of that. I said, well, there's the issue. You have an overwhelmed brain pattern and you've now pushed beyond its abilities, you know, and depending on where that shows up at different stages of life, it'll show up in different ways. It doesn't go away though. If you don't recognize it and support it, it will not go away. When your kid is 8 years old, it looks like, you know, when you tell the kid to go upstairs, get your shoes and meet me in the car, and they go upstairs and they start playing with their toys. And you're like, did you not hear me? Are you not listening? Like, what's going on? That's how it shows up in an 8-year-old. But then as we get older, it just changes. It just changes to the environment. And so, it's really important that we recognize what those patterns are, particularly the overwhelm patterns, because they can be, they can create a lot of despair for people.
That's reminding me of my own last postpartum. My daughter was diagnosed with laryngomalacia, so like floppy vocal cords. She spit up everything. She had a very hard time gaining weight. Everything was covered in, I'm like not kidding, everything was covered in spit up. Like I was finding dried white milk spots on like my furniture, my shoes, like everywhere. And it was disrupting her sleep, obviously, her feeding patterns. It was crazy for like the first 4 months. And I had never really been a fiction book reader. I'd always read nonfiction to learn more things and whatever. And anyway, I was influenced by some kind of video to read this book, and like a nonfiction fantasy romanticy book. Yeah. And it was like the gateway for me. I loved reading these books so much. And even if I just read the book for like 20 or 30 minutes each day, it gave me that bump and like, yeah, maybe it was escape. I don't know what it was, but it really filled my cup to be able to have the mental resilience to deal with the rest of the difficulty of the day. Yeah. Like it was such a simple tool, but I was like, oh, this is what people are talking about when they say self-care. Cause like, I do actually like to take a bath, but like a face mask does nothing for me, you know, like whatever that other thing that people love to do, like alcohol does nothing for me. Like there's just certain things, but that I was like, oh, it really locked in for me and clicked and made such a big impact. Oh my gosh. If I don't do this in the day, I am so much more unhappy. Yeah. And if I do this very simple thing, read a book for 20 minutes, I'm so much more pleasant.
Yeah. But imagine if we could have done that to you when you were 15 or 12 or whatever. And we said, look, here's your options of things you need for escape. And if you don't, you know, this is where it could lead. We probably wouldn't say that, but this is, you know, this is what could happen. But if you do, here's, you know, it's like a choose your own adventure life, you know, but you have the map to tell you what to do. And so people who we're talking about this on the special that we're shooting right now, is that the difference between professional racing drivers and meth addicts. Okay, we've looked at brain scans of both. I used to work with a lot of racing drivers, and I've worked with a lot of substance use people. Okay, the difference is I can't even tell. If you put them both in front of me, I couldn't tell who's using meth and who's doing race cars. Okay, and who's driving race cars. And just to your point, like as we start to find these things that scratch these itches for us, some of them are healthy and some of them aren't. And so if we find those things, if we're lucky enough and we have, you know, been exposed to a lot of choices of things, then, you know, hopefully those itches get scratched and we go to that toolbox when we're feeling that way. But if we don't, what we're probably going to do is lean on to, you know, what did you see on social? What did you see on TV? What did you learn from your parents that you either emulate or you run away from? And so I think, again, when we talk about these in the context of, you know, generational kind of big picture things, and you even talked about this on one of your podcasts over the summer with trauma, like if we can overcome these challenges, I think they'll have profound effects generationally, because we wrestle with our own brain patterns and our own things that we're struggling with so that it doesn't get passed on to the next generation. And again, if it's just about guessing, like, we're not here for that long. I don't want to guess for that long, you know? And so when we find it, though, I think it can be really quite a hack to understanding your kid, your spouse, yourself, you know, even the people around you, and understand to give them grace because they have this pattern. That's why they do this thing. You know, it's fascinating. This is a really fascinating thing about this pattern. And I always come back to this one about the self-deprecating pattern is, if you've been around people who are really boastful, you know, they tend to brag about, oh, I'm going here and I've got this Gucci bag, I've got this and I've got this. A lot of times those people have the negative self-referencing patterns, okay? And when you see those in a brain scan, it's like, oh, that's why they do this thing. And I think that the grace that can come from that can just be like, oh, like, let it go. Who cares? Like, that's just their way of doing it, you know? This happens with buddies of mine. I have two buddies that are both, I have more than two buddies, maybe three, but I have two buddies, both high-level fitness gurus, okay? Like the kind that would be in shows and all this stuff. And they spend most of their day in the gym just beating themselves up. Like, oh, you're a wimp, you're whatever, like, tons of bad self-talk. But how they get that out is through their exercise and through their fitness. And you see that as, wow, this is an athlete. This is person's like, amazingly fit and whatever, but really that's their sort of compensatory mechanism for these patterns. So I think when you see that, when you start to understand that these are the filters through which people interpret the world, none of them are right and wrong. Just like if you walk in my house right now, it's 72, I am hot, you might be cold. We're both right. You know what I'm saying? Right. Now extrapolate that to everything, to politics, to war, to women's rights, to all of these things, and immigration, all these controversial things. We all filter these things through our own brain patterns. And that is at least in part how we determine and assign it a value. And I think when you see that, it's like, oh, I can have so much more compassion for you or my spouse or my kids. Because when we're walking around, even if we walked around, held hands all day and experienced the exact same thing, we would be living two totally different lives because of the way that we interpret this information. It's completely different lives, okay? And so when you think about things as profoundly as sort of, you know, abstract and metaphysical than that, it's how can we boil something down to as simple as you have depression, take this medication. It's so much more complex than that, you know?
Yeah, it's almost insulting to think that it would be that simple.
It is. And that's what I wanted to mention, actually, is that normal brains are boring people. You want to have abnormal patterns. You want to. It's what makes this interesting. Like creative people, if you're in a creative outlet, an actress or an actor or a writer, you should have creative patterns. If you don't, it's going to be very hard for you. Very hard. And I can show you that over and over in our data set. The people who struggle in creative endeavors that don't have creative patterns. And so having those things are gifts, again, in the right environment. And so if you can see that, then we can, you know, we can create these environments. So I don't know where we're going with that, but
go ahead.
No, I think there's just so much to really unpack. And I think, it largely helps us understand, you know, even our own children. You know, like if you have a kid who has like an emotionally sort of sensitive pattern, and you may be able to criticize one of your children, we'll just say, hypothetically, this happens, and one of them can take the criticism, but the other one internalizes all of that and becomes sort of self-critical, but you don't know because they don't talk about it, you know? But if you see that in the brain scans, now you can tailor your sort of patterning, your parenting to their patterns, you know? And I mean, just think about that and the implications for relationships. I just think about how many marriages would still be around if you just understood, hey, we're trying to get a husky to live in the desert. No wonder they're miserable and we're fighting all the time. Like, how do we get us to both be in an environment that we're happy in, you know?
Okay, I have a question for you about that. So say that we see a particular pattern on a brain scan. It's whatever, XYZ thing. And then there's a treatment, mm-hmm. whatever thing. Will then, if we retest the brain scan, does it change?
Yeah, most of the time. Wow. Not all.
So you can literally see that it's working.
Yeah, you can see. And generally, treatments, we'll just say generally, and this is in context of herbs, supplements, meds, even psychedelics now, which we're studying a lot now too, is a whole nother can of worms. They will generally shift the brain. If a person's symptoms are improving, it will generally shift it in the direction of people who don't have symptoms. I'm purposefully not saying normal because I don't think normal exists. It's a big problem within the field, and I think it's why the field has not gone as far as it had in the time that it's been around, is because we still try to get people to either, we try to get the patterns to fit into the DSM, which isn't going to happen, we talked about that, or we try to get you to look like these, what we call large normative databases, which, again, if you're following along, we just said like normal is only the absence of symptoms in an environment that's supportive. It doesn't mean your brain looks like somebody on the other side of the planet, you know? And so to try to take a bigger and bigger number and say, okay, these are people who don't have ADHD and these are people who do, I think it's a fallacy. So when we do medications, we do supplements, we've done supplement studies, we've done herb studies, we can see these changes in the brain. When they move in a direction that people generally don't have symptoms, people generally feel better. And so that's what we look for. But it isn't like a routine thing to do, to just do pre and post all the time. We do that mostly for our research partners, but not just in clinical use. It's more, you know, here's what you've got, do this treatment, now come back and tell us how you're doing.
I really love this because before we started recording, I had asked you a question and I think I got my answer now, which is how do you, I was literally going to text a friend this yesterday mm-hmm. who works in pediatrics. How do I, what are the resources that I can read about so I can figure out what's age appropriate for my kids? You know, our firstborns are always sort of the big experiment in the family because we've never had a child that age. And it's like, unfortunately for them, but then there's character development that happens from that. But, you know, something I'm struggling with right now is like, are certain things that my like 10-year-old is doing, is that age appropriate? Am I being too hard on him in my expectations? Is yeah. there something going on with this? So it would be really great to be able to have a tool, because I have suspicions that maybe his brain is like mine, and that's okay. I would just love to know it, you know, so that we can work together. Because I'm like, I see some pieces of it. I don't remember how I was at 10. You know, I see how I am now, how I've coped with different things. And it would just be so lovely to get this information. And it reminds me of genetic testing. You know, I feel like this is becoming much more common for not as complex as it all. It always used to be like, oh, we'll do your whole genetic code if you have this very, very complex yeah. picture. But now it's like people are doing genetic testing, sometimes even just preventatively, to understand what SNPs do you have? Why do you feel weird when you take that thing? And why do you feel okay when this is happening? And how can we help ourselves? And it's not like a super like bougie tool anymore. It's sort of, I mean, it is expensive, and I'm sure these scans are not, you know, pennies, but what a beneficial, amazing thing to be able to understand. And like you said too, like if someone had taught me when I was 12, reading books like this can be a really, really good coping mechanism when things get wild in my life. It's like, wow, how beautiful to equip our young people with this information and understand it without that shame, and as just like yet another tool. So, but how do people, like if I was a mom and I wanted to find this scan technology, is there a database website I can go to, or how do I find people that yeah. can do it?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's probably like four questions in there, but I think
yeah, sorry.
The first one that I'm really the most interested, I think, in talking about is, and we can get to all of them, but is about, you know, what behavior is expected. And so, mm-hmm. you know, there's normative behavior around you that you would get with like a psych eval if you were to see a psychologist or see a therapist who's well-versed in working with children, or even a psychiatrist that's, you know, working more around child development and less around, you know, a label and a medication. And like a lot of things in medicine, I mean, if you see one, you've only seen one, you know, I mean, there's a lot of variation between those providers, but that would be kind of your typical route. Now, what I would argue for is to add the objective data layer to the conversation to understand, okay, is this an appropriate behavior for this breed of dog in this environment? You know what I'm saying? So not to compare the kid to a dog, but we understand dogs because we have books about them, and we have the internet, and we have all these things that we can like understand through years of breeding them what to expect from a husky or a Saint Bernard or whatever, okay? And so if we add that layer of objective data, what we can say is, okay, here's my 10-year-old, here's their brain patterns. Now, are we creating ecosystems that support that, or are we giving supplements and herbs that support it? Or are they making those patterns worse? Like, what does that all look like? So that way, you can then get a fair evaluation of what's going on. Because again, the symptoms are just the check engine light to say, hey, something's going on. So I'll give you an example. This is a pretty cool example. My boys used to race go-karts competitively for years. And by competitively, we traveled all over the place. It was a circus. It was everything that I did after work for like till like 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, most days of the week. And we traveled all over. And every other weekend we were in Phoenix. Like, this was an intense like endeavor. And we got to kind of the end of my patience, and I said, you know what, we can't do this anymore, guys. It's too toxic. There was a lot of fights with parents. It was just a really toxic environment. And if you think kids' hockey is toxic or football, like, this is like times 100, because there's like way more dollars involved. It was so toxic. And it's adrenaline, and kids are, you know, going 60 miles an hour. So anyways, we stopped racing, and within the first 2 months, the boys are having all kinds of behavior problems, like all kinds of problems. And they're fighting, and one would come home crying from school and all of this stuff. And one day we're walking around the block, and I was like, what are we going to do with these kids? Like, you know, they're almost to the point of like, you know, this is a kid I would bring into our clinic. Like, what's going on? And then it dawned on me, and this was kind of early in this sort of piecing all of this together, that they went from driving around the track at 60 miles an hour most days of the week to nothing, to absolutely nothing. It's like, well, yeah, no wonder all they want to do is play video games and fight. Like, yeah, because we could blame it on the video games, sure. But it was largely that their needs weren't being met. So immediately after that, we got them, both of them into music, both of them into sports, like I'm talking like the next day. And the behaviors just sort of fizzled away, and we weren't having no more fights after school. They were getting along, and it was like, it was just a little shift, almost like you were talking about with the book. It was a little shift, but it was enough to help them to begin to meet their needs. So again, if you were to evaluate my kid when they were in the middle of their fighting, he would look like a kid with, you know, outburst, like oppositional defiance, maybe lowered impulse control, all these things. But when we started to create an ecosystem where they've got a music room, they've got a rock wall, they've got monkey bars, and I mean, it took some work to like do all this stuff and to create this environment. But when you do, that's when you see these kids thrive. And you know, the next thing you know, we've got kids doing amazing stuff and, you know, playing on stages all around Denver and doing all kinds of cool stuff. And it's like, it's not because there's some gift. It's because we put the husky with the pack, with the sled, and we let him run in Alaska. And it was like, that's what he's born to do. That's what he's, but it wasn't guessing. It was because I did 20 brain scans on them from the time they were 5 to 15, you know? So yeah.
Okay, question about that though, as a mom, would doing something like, say, if I didn't really love the idea of my kid doing such dangerous adrenaline-y things, right, like for their future, is there evidence or the idea that having them do those kinds of repetitive things is making that pattern stronger in the brain? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so. We don't look at it through so much through that measure. Like a lot of our work is what's called resting state. So we see what's happening in the moment when you're sitting there and usually some sort of small task, a challenge or whatnot. But not actually in the moment. That's where a lot of the researchers are, you know, kind of studying this long term. Mm. But yeah, I think that there's something to be said that the level of stimulation that we're driven to continues to sort of increase if we keep pushing that envelope, right? Because like we don't, you know, at one point a bicycle is exciting for us, and at one point, you know, a dirt bike is exciting, but after a while we need jumps, you know, and you kind of keep pushing that envelope. But again, if you look at the scan, I think you can start to, or not even with the scan, but just understand how do we create a diverse ecosystem that would support this child. So like, let me give you my artist child, my other one. You know, we used to have crayons and chalk, and they would, you know, put it on the sidewalk when they come home. And one of the things that if you have a creative kid, you tell them, hey, go get your art supplies and go outside and color. They're like, no, I'm going to go play video games or play my iPad or whatever. That's way more fun. But if you put the chalk on the driveway when they come home and they see it, it's like, oh, wow, this is all of a sudden exciting. So that worked for like 2 or 3 years. But then it doesn't work anymore because they're like 8 and they're like, chalk is lame. So then we create, we did this in the backyard. I put this big wood panel and we got them non-toxic spray paint. And we started watching YouTube videos about how to do graffiti. So graffiti, it's like, oh, that's naughty. Spray paint, like that's stimulating, you know? And now I can spray paint in my backyard. Like, this is amazing. And it's like, it's just starting to think about how can we create, you know, an environment that continues to evolve with the individual, you know, around that. So I think the biggest challenge we have is that the screens do such a good job of scratching most of the itches that we encounter with kids, so that if you give them the opportunity, the other gifts never get realized. And so it's so predictable that, you know, that those needs will get met through those screens. We've written papers on this too, actually, screen addictions in kids and in adults, 2 separate papers. And if you don't recognize that that's what it's doing, they're real gifts. It's hard to see them. You know, it's hard to see those.
Oh, it is the biggest. It's such a struggle. Mm-hmm. I really thought I would be just better about being able to manage it. And then there's of course like differences between my husband and I, like he grew up with screen, like playing video games. So he has really good fond memories of it. And I'm like, but babe, the video games are not the same anymore. So, you know, there's always that, but okay. I have 2 questions for you and I know we need to follow up. But so first off, if I wanted a scan, how can I find somebody who does this?
Yeah, so that's part of why we got the book out, is that we're trying to expand this beyond where it's been stuck for so long. So EEGs, and QEG in particularly, what we've been talking about, quantitative EEG, has been stuck in the sort of neurotherapy world for a very long time. And so the way most people could only ever get a scan was if they were doing a form of neurotherapy, usually neurofeedback, and it was sort of stuck there. And so what we tried to do is bring it out into mainstream mental health, so all the stuff we've been talking about. And so part of the book and part of, you know, my mission now is to go out and sort of spread the word of being able to apply this in other ways. So we have a group of providers around the country that can do scans for us. And then if you go onto actually our website, the Axon, it's on axoneegsolutions.com. If you go onto there, you click I'm a patient, and we can plug you into providers who partner with us. Because the key is, anyone could collect the data if they have an EEG amplifier. What we want to be able to do is to take that data and turning it into something meaningful for you. Mm-hmm. Not unlike the genetic test you talked about. Like, you can go get a genetic, a profile, but what do you do with the information? You know, and so that's what we want to try to do, is to translate it into something usable. So it's an easy scan, takes about 20 minutes. Most kids over about 8 years old, and then of course adults, can do that, and then they send us the data, and then we generate these reports. So that's usually how it works. And we have clinics all over the country, and now expanding into other countries too.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. And then the book, which again, let me just repeat the title. It's called Think Like a Brain: A New Map for Treating Minds That Don't Fit the Manual. Mm-hmm. Is this beneficial? I know it's written for providers, but is it something the parents would also benefit from?
Yeah, actually, we wrote it through the lens of both. We found that most of the providers that we started working with actually were patients first. And so, you know, they had a kid, they had a spouse, they had, you know, whatever. And then once they were able to see how they can, you know, use that information, how valuable it was, then they brought it into their practice. So when we wrote the book, that was the intention, was to try to kind of speak to both. So you can read it, you can start to understand why there's such a problem with the subjectivity and how we can translate that into our day-to-day lives. We do it through the story of a girl that we first treated that really sort of opened our eyes to all of this. I think it's equally as helpful for providers. But I think largely, you know, patients read and then they go to their provider and say, hey, I want to do this. Like, you know, can we do couples therapy knowing what our brains look like? Or can we help my kid? Or can we figure out why these antidepressants haven't worked or whatnot, you know?
Wow. Okay. Well, Steve, by the time this podcast is dropping, the book will be out. And so it is linked in the show notes along with all of the different resources to find Dr. Steve and learn more. I think this has been really awesome and so interesting. Hopefully one day it will just be very mainstream. You know, that's the hope and the goal, because it seems like, why wouldn't it be? It's just, I know that this kind of stuff takes a long time to get enacted. So thank you for everything that you're doing, all the endless hours of research and work, and your passion is very clear. It's been wonderful talking to you today.
Yeah, thanks. It's been great being on here, and you know, someone who can appreciate this through different lenses like you, you know, from the clinical side to your own personal side to the kids. I think it's really applicable, and I hope that we can, yeah, one day take all the guesswork out of this and take the shame and guilt and all that stuff that goes along with it.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you. Are you pregnant or you're trying to conceive and you're looking for reliable natural health information about how to have a healthy pregnancy and also prepare for the future steps in motherhood to come, like the birth, the breastfeeding, and the postpartum? Because I have got you. So this is exactly the reason why I made the 6-week pregnancy call. And it's my most comprehensive resource. It's the thing that I absolutely love. I've poured my heart and soul into it. It's all of the things that I wish that every woman knew when they are entering motherhood. It's a pregnancy health course, birth prep series, breastfeeding 101 class, and a postpartum planning course all in one. And normally I run it as a class with live Q&A calls, but now it's available in a content-only format so that you can purchase it at any time and start learning immediately. It's called the lessons-only format, and it is just only all of the video lessons that you'll get access to for forever. So log on to milkmedicine.com/lessons-only or check out the link in the show notes.
In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and share with a friend who would benefit from this content. Please remember that the views and ideas from this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to be a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis and treatment of any disease. Consult with your provider before integrating any of this information into your own healthcare plan. A healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.